Tathaya Pati Bodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranam Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Tadvaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusantadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavadvaishini. One verse in chapter 15, verse 5. Nirmana moha jita sanga doshaha. Nirmana moha jita sanga doshaha. Adhyatma nitya vinivritta kamaha. Adhyatma nitya vinivritta kamaha. Dvandvar vimukta sukha dukkha sanyaihi. Dvandvar vimukta sukha dukkha sanyaihi. Kachantya mudhaf paramavyayam tata. Kachantya mudhaf paramavyayam tata. Nirmana mohaha, during the Sunday. Nirmana mohaha jitta sanga doshaha. Dvandvaihi vimuktaha. Sukha dukha sanyaihi. Gachanti amudaha padam avyayam tat. In verse 3 and 4, taking these two together, in the end of verse 3, that he begins by telling this tree of samsara, you don't really know what it is. It has no beginning, it has no end, in the middle it's not really here. You don't really understand what this samsara vriksha, this tree of samsara really is. Because this ashwatha tree, ashwatha tree means this tree that keeps on changing. It won't be here tomorrow. Every moment is different, this ashwatha tree. He says its roots, it is very well rooted. Means if you remember the secondary roots of this ashwatha tree, come down and ground you with all of the karmas, all of the vishyas, all of the sense objects, and your pursuit of these sense objects which create punya and papa. All of these, this punya and papa that is really the result of your karmas, and the karmas are there because you're going after your likes and dislikes. These karmas create secondary roots that just hold you down into the samsara vriksha. So he says, this vriksha can only be filled really through asanga, through vairagya. And then in the verse 6 he says, and so he says, when that, having cut down this tree with this vairagya, with this asangatvam, he says, then that pada, that abode, means Brahman, that which, whether we use, as we'll see in this next verse, whether you use the word pada, which means an abode, or dhamma, which also means an abode. Swamiji explains this so nicely. In the first portion of the Vedas, we talk about, and even in all religions, we talk about that heavenly world or that place that we want to get to. That's the pada, that the gati. Gati means the thing that we actually want to reach, where we want to end up. So whether you say pada, that place, that abode, or gati, that thing that has been reached, or dhamma, dhamma again has the sense of this place to be reached, where I'm doing all of, making all of these efforts to get there. So here, in terms of self-knowledge, in terms of moksha, we're using the same word, except here, this word pada, is, if we look at this verse 4, when we use the word pada, means after we've gained this vairagya, this asangatvam, this non-attachment, then that padam is something which needs to be thoroughly inquired into. And what is that pada that needs to be thoroughly inquired into? It's that pada having gone to which there is no return. Having reached which, having entered into which, having gone to which, there is no return. And then he says that pada, that alone is the, I seek refuge in the pada, which is that purusha. The purusha means that purusha which is the cause, the adya, the cause of everything. That purusha from which this whole creation comes. And so now when we're using the pada as that which is to be reached, we are going to get rid of the idea that that pada is something that I can reach in terms of traveling to. It's a pada that I gain in terms of knowledge. Right? I actually am that padam. I am that dhamma. I am that gati, which I can only achieve through the removal of ignorance, because I already am that. But it's the reaching that, the gain of that, is what all beings seek. It's the gain of that liberation. So we look at it, keeping that same theme that goes through the whole first part of the Vedas. It's like reaching the heavenly world, you know, or getting that great pada that I'm working for. Here, in terms of moksha, I'm working for this great pada. But this particular pada is something gaining which there is no return. Because really the gain is the gain of the already gained. We have a term in Sanskrit, it's called praptasya praptihi, the gain of the gained. And so here you can say reaching what has already been reached, gaining what has already been gained, it's the gain of the gained. What causes me to have that duality, gaining what is already gained, is only ajnanam, is only ignorance. So it's the removal of the ignorance that is actually the gain. So having set this up, talking about now the one that through this vairagya, through this asangatvam, once that asangatvam is there, that vairagya is there, then this has got to be inquired into. The next question, and this is verse 5, the next question is, what type of person, you know, who is it? What type of person, you know, goes to that pada? Goes to that pada from which there is no return. That's the idea. So here he says, these are all definitions of this person, of really the adhikari, the one who's an adhikari, a qualified student for this knowledge. Nirmana mohaha. The one who has nirmana and moha. Nirmana and nirmoha means the one who is free. Nir means free from mana and moha. Mana means that need for respect, the need to have respect from others. And so Swamiji will talk about this. This comes also, if you remember, this everything that's listed here, you can really find it in chapter 13 of the Gita, the Mani Twama Dambi Twama Hemsa Kshanti Arjavam, all of these things. There's a list here also. So the first one is this amanitvam. If I say amanitvam, that a negates, nir negates, right? So mana, nirmana, or amana. Nirmana means being without mana, being without the need to be respected. And so what that means is I need to be respected because I don't feel respected inside. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm lacking that self-esteem or self-worth, and so I require others in order to give me that feeling that I'm okay, or that I'm important, or that I matter, because I don't have that, it's not internalized. So if I don't have that internalized, usually, really, we get that internalization, hopefully from our parents when you're growing up, you know. Even Freud talks about this, Jung, all psychologists talk about that. And how it really works is when you're little, the first 3 or 4 years especially, nature has set it up, Bhagawan set it up, that the little baby, little child, is to the parents, when the parents aren't distracted or too hurt themselves, there is nothing more important than the little baby. That is it. And all the parents do is sit around and stare at their baby and talk about the baby. And if you're a guest at the house of somebody who has had a baby, it's all only about the baby, only about the baby, only about the baby. And so that little baby is soaking up, you know, attention and love. You know, and it's kind of, it's just ordained. That's how it is. But if that's happening, then they are getting internalized. I'm the most important thing in the world, because actually they are the most important thing in the world. So they get a structure inside that gives them that sort of support. I'm an important little person, you know. And so as they grow up, that doesn't translate into the narcissistic, I am an important person. That, in fact, happens when they don't get that. But if you grow up naturally having gotten so much love, you feel self-confident. Nobody has to tell you that you're an important person. Nobody has to tell you that you're loved, because you are loved. Right? You don't need that from the outside. And that gives you a certain freedom and a certain objectivity in facing any given situation, because all the situations, in a way, you become, in a sense, relatively free from. You don't need a person to be behaving towards you in a particular way in order for you to feel loved, you know. So rather, when a person is behaving in a way that is negative or hurtful to you, you might feel something like, oh, I wonder what's wrong with them. Rather than take it inside. Somji always says, you have to keep people outside, keep them outside. Says to all of them. I never knew what he meant, but I finally figured it out 20 years later. You know, keep them outside. Let them have their own life. Give them their space to have their own problems. But if you yourself are wounded inside, you know, then you need to be fed by the outside. So there's work, for psychological work for us to do, just in terms of the inner interjects that are in there, so for this to really get rid of this need for self-respect. Now, say I've done that work, right? Then on another level, this need for being respected in order for you to feel okay, that also goes away at a different level. And that, now this level, it's really your knowledge, where in terms of your own being, who is there to respect who? Mm-hmm. Because really there's only one being there. And the being, the conscious being that I am, these words don't even apply to conscious to me. That somebody needs to respect me or disrespect me is totally irrelevant. Because my being as it is not subject to that duality. And so as I recognize myself, the idea of needing to be respected or not respected is something that falls off, both in terms of my own swarupa, in terms of my own nature, you know, and also just the recognition that there is no second person here. The me that I am is you. There's not two of us. There's only one me. There's two bodies. There's two, many, infinite number of bodies, countless number of sense organs, countless number of minds, countless, infinite number of vrittis, thought modifications. All of that is in Maya. That's all in duality. But me, there aren't two me's. So the me that I am is the me that you are. You know, is the me that the rug is the me that the flower is the me that all beings are. And so there's no question of me respecting or not respecting me, because there's no dvaita there. And so that becomes that understanding. Once some of this inner child work has been is taken care of on its own level, that understanding becomes something that I can relax into when my mind's behaving in a different way. What? When my mind is behaving in a different way, like getting lost in samsara, I need this or I need that, you can pull your mind back to what you know. Now, that's a sadhana. That's our sadhana, really. We have different levels of sadhana. There's all this inner child work to take care of wounded parts and the structure of our psyche. But then there's this, the owning up of our knowledge. Like, if I know myself, my mind can be still running around like crazy, but I know myself, I can bring my mind back to the reality of myself when I'm acting in a way that is as though I don't know. I'm acting as though I don't know who I am, then I can bring myself and my mind back, you know. And one of the things I bring my mind back to is just the recognition of my being, the one being that I am. It's just it's like a nididhyasana throughout the day. Nididhyasana is contemplation, just a moment of contemplation where I bring my mind home. And I get used to doing that. As soon as I recognize any pain or distress, I can check out that, what's that all about. You check it out internally in terms of this inner child stuff. You check it out externally in terms of how you're getting lost, for what reason. It all happens almost instantaneously, and you just come home. I was thinking, you know, I remember when I was young going to sometimes these scary movies. We'd go to the theater, some friends, we'd all go to the theater, and there'd be some scary thing going on that you didn't want to see, you know. And so we just shut our eyes like that, you know. And I wouldn't open my eyes until I knew it was over, you know. So, but you know what? I could shut my eyes, and this is what we all do. Because we know it's just a movie, right? It's not real. It's a movie, but you've got lost in that movie, and you're getting kind of ripped to shreds by the movie, and you don't want to experience it. So you just shut your eyes, and the movie goes away for the moment. So then you're fine. You wait till it all stopped, and then you can open your eyes again. How many of us have done that? And I'm sure we all have, actually. Okay, so the thing is, what's so funny, I guess you could, in these scary, horrible movies, you know, which I still to this day, I really don't like to watch them. And if I get this scary movie, scary music comes on, you know, when the scary music comes on, then I'll quickly try to turn the channel or something, get rid of it. Because I know some horrible thing is coming, so I'll try to, you know, get rid of it. But, you know, if I wanted to, I could, because I had to watch these scary movies, I could train myself to just be objective toward the scary movie, because whether I close my eyes or I keep my eyes open, I know that it is a movie. That I have jnana nishtha in the moviness of this thing. And I think life for us, when you gain knowledge, life is a little bit like that, in the sense that sometimes the situation is something that your mind is not really able to deal with. It's kind of like a scary movie, you know. And so you're not really in a situation, don't have the objectivity to sit in the middle of that situation and keep your shanti. Your mind's not ready for it, right? And so then you can just withdraw. Because you know that it's mitya, the whole thing. That's what I'm saying. As you gain some nishtha in your knowledge, you know that it's mitya, you can draw your mind back to your knowledge, to yourself, and then be engaged in the situation that way. You bring your mind back because you get lost in the situation. It's caught you, like a scary movie, it's caught you. So you can bring your mind back to your knowledge, to yourself. There will come a time when you don't need to bring your mind back because it's already back. See what I mean? It's already back. And so the movie, what's going on, this particular person or this particular situation, just simply is not a problem. Even though it may be unpleasant, it may not be the best situation, but it's not a problem for you. But if it is a problem for your mind, then you can just bring your mind home because you have a home to go to. It's very simple, really. We do it in our own way in reference to these scary movies because the moviness of the movie is clear, right? In just a second, you can change your mind from being lost in the movie to recognizing that it's a movie. Right? And we can do the same, and we do the same here. If you get lost in the movie, you know, then you can remember that it's a movie, you know, and bring your mind back to the self that's exactly the same. That's just it's just something that the mind will naturally do. And as this vairagya, as the vairagya goes on increasing, and what is the vairagya that they're talking about? Is in this next word, moha. Nirmana, the first one we're talking about, has to do with self-esteem, recognizing and recognizing the wholeness of myself, where self-esteem is not an issue. I don't need to be respected because myself can't be more respected than it is. It can't be more than what it is. The moha has to do with superimposing ananda, or the wholeness, the ananda, the fullness of myself, onto the world. And so that means, that's where the lack of vairagya. I need this in order to be happy. I need you to treat me in this way in order to be happy. It's very subtle. It goes from the most gross to the more subtle, to the most subtle. I need. I need this to be happy. I need to be loved by you to be happy. I need to be respected by you to be happy. I need this to be happy. I need this to be happy. There comes a time when you gain a certain level of nishta in your knowledge, where you can just, clarity in your knowledge, when you see your mind doing this moha, projecting your well-being onto the situation, you can, even without words, you can ask your mind, do you really need this to be happy? Do you really need it to be happy? And then there's a little, if you give your mind a little bit of space to do some inquiry. And just a question like that helps you to bring your mind back. So here he's saying, for the mind to be mature, to where when gaining this knowledge I don't come back again, it means I've become mature in this way. I don't have a need for self-respect, means the issue doesn't come up. The need doesn't come up. Right? I'm not projecting onto the world anymore, saying I need you to be this way or I need this to be this way in order for me to be happy. That doesn't come up. It doesn't come up because over time with this knowledge I've matured. That's what maturation is all about. Now, one way to understand this so it doesn't seem daunting is that you can look now at, for just something simple like this nirmana, and this moha that we can all relate to, how you have grown in reference to your needs, or how you have grown in reference to your freedom from needs. In fact, for everybody, even an ajnani, one who doesn't have any knowledge, there are so many situations where I have no needs in reference to that situation at all. I have no needs at all. Because there's no raga dvesha, there's no likes and dislikes there. I'm completely objective toward a great percentage of my situation. So then that means that there's a handful of things that I have to deal with. And those things become my sadhana. Those are the triggers. Those triggers are my sadhana. The things that cause me pain are my sadhana. So here, in needing others to respect me, I have to go inside and see why I'm so hurt. You know, in thinking that I need all of these things to be happy, again, I have to analyze, you know, why do I need this? Why do I think I need this? Why am I putting my ananda onto these objects? Because in whatever way you do that, there's suffering. Why am I doing it? I don't really need it. But sometimes I have to work through all of that, so until it becomes natural. Then jitasanga doshaha. Jitasanga doshaha means I'm free. Those who are the doshas, the defect of attachment they are totally free from. This is also really an amazing sadhana. Sangha means to have that attachment. Swamiji says something interesting, which I've also experienced this. Sometimes we don't know what we're attached to until it's threatened. The loss of that given thing is threatened. And then you realize, you feel that pull in your heart that without that thing, how can I survive? How will I manage without that? So that's the sangha, you know? So jitta sangha doshaha means a person who is completely free of that. Jitta means conquered. That sangha is completely conquered, you know, which means, you know, that my, it doesn't mean that it's an interesting thing. It doesn't mean that I don't love. And it doesn't mean that I don't care. But it means if that object of love were to go away, I would be fine. Swamiji tells the story. I've tried to tell it before. But there was the sea captain on in the ocean. He was traveling to some far off country, and somebody came in. But they're approaching a dock, and somebody came on board and told the captain, the person who came on said something like to the captain, you know, there was a huge fire at your home, and your whole palace has burned to the ground. And this captain, he goes, what? So Swami says this, what? What? You know? And then, so what? He says. Took me a long time to understand the story too. Yeah. He goes, what? So what? And then the old guy comes on and he says, and your wife was also in the palace and she was killed. He goes, what? So what? And you lost all your children also. What?
Man.
And that's the vairagya. What I don't like about the story is when we say so what, there's a negative connotation to it. In India they don't have that negative, like so what.
Do you remember what
vairagya is? Vairagya means dispassion. Yeah. And by dispassion, it's not a negative. So dispassion is like we use the example of a helium balloon for a child. The child loses that helium balloon, mm-hmm. It's very upsetting. But if an adult loses it, it's fine, mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's not positive or negative, it's freedom from, I can enjoy it when it's there, and when it's not there, I'm absolutely fine. You know? So that story is an extreme. It's actually, I think it's in the Sampradaya, the story. It's a story that's told for vairagya, what it means, you know. Because you can love your wealth. So it just went through all of the things that a person is attached to. You love your wealth and your possessions. You love your family. You love your partner. You love your family. But all of these things are subject to loss. That's just the nature of the world. Everything that you love, everything you're attached to, is subject to loss. Say you have an important position. That's subject to loss. There's no exception. Even your healthy body is subject to loss. Even it's subject to aging. Like when we were at the ashram on the East Coast, with a group of us were, we were with Swamiji and we were in the temple along the side there, where they have a bunch of pictures. And there were some pictures of him when he was young, like in his 40s. And some of those pictures he was looking at, I'd actually taken them. And we'd use those pictures to put on talks, to advertise some of his talks. And he looked at those pictures, and here he was probably around 70 or so at that time. Now he's in his 80s. He looked and said, I miss that guy. I miss that guy. Because he was so young, so strong.
Sturdy,
you know, so much energy. And then when he was probably in his 70s, I miss that guy. But he can say that smilingly, you know, I miss that guy. Because all of these things that we will lose and can lose. So to be able to love, this is how the most beautiful way, I think, to understand Vairagya, is to be able to love and to be engaged, to care, to be human, to have all of the human feelings of love and care and engagement and relationship. And when that is taken away from you, right, to go, and then it's okay. What I like about, there's two things there. There's, you know, like that, because you're human, you know. So there's that blast, what? And then it's okay. And there's your knowledge. There's the blast, the human blast, and then your knowledge. So it's, okay. So instead of so what, which the way they say, we wouldn't say that, maybe we would say,
So it is.
So it is. Yeah. Like, so it is. Yeah. So that's that jitta sangha doshaha. Means for who the sangha has been conquered. Conquered means that it's not in control of you. That you're in control of it. You're free of it. So thing to understand, because I feel like this is something that is often, I don't know, not understood properly. You know, is that Vairagya is not the absence of love. It's not becoming like a person who has no human emotion or no feelings or no care or no engagement, kind of like a zombie. It's not like becoming a zombie. It's like having the freedom to love, but having the source of love be very clearly your own being. You know, so that source of love can't be taken away. But that doesn't mean that you can't be fully engaged and be able to love someone. I would say even more than an ajnani can love. Because an ajnani, when you don't have knowledge, there's a lot of strings attached to that love. You know, because you require that person or situation to be in a particular way. Because you, like everybody, what you really love is the way they make you feel loved. That's what you love. You love the way they make you feel loved, or the way they make you feel important, or the way they make you feel wanted. But when your loved one is not making you feel loved, is not making you feel wanted, is not making you feel important, and you find you don't love them very much in that moment. Right? And so to the degree that you have demands on that person to make you feel loved, to that degree they're on a slippery slope, because they have to be behaving in a particular way all of the time that happens to be just right at that moment to make you feel whole. And so sometimes they might be trying really hard, but they're not saying quite the right thing. Trying really hard, not behaving in quite the right way, not wearing quite the right outfit, whatever it is. So what about when your ananda, your wholeness, is not at stake, and that person is given so much more freedom? So that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. So jitta sangha doshaha, then adhyatma nityaha. Those people, in order to have any of this other, this jitta sangha doshaha, this adhyatma nityaha, means they are always, that person is always really centered. Adi means centered on the self. Not on the ego. centered on the nature of your being, which is Brahman. So the mind always, nitya means always with the self. The mind is always with the self. You know, when I think of this one, this adhyatma nityaha, nityaha means knowledge of pearl. Nitya means always. Adhi means on. All you're always centered on, the atma, on the self. What we say for therapists in psychology, as a therapist, psychologist working with their client in the, you know, their hourly session with the client, should always have 1 foot in and 1 foot out. Mm-hmm. You know? 1 foot in, 1 foot out. 1 foot in means that you're engaged, you're living, you're a person. You're engaged in whatever it is that's going on between the two of you. But so that's the 1 foot in. But at the same time, there's 1 foot out because you're listening with that third ear, the ear of the psychologist, you know, and so that you can offer help to the situation. But if you're not engaged, there's nothing happening in the room. Mm-hmm. So you have to be engaged. Your feelings have to be engaged. And at the same time, that's not all that's going on. And so for you as a jnani, for somebody, all of this is going on at the same time. That 1 foot in means the mind is always with your being. That's, it's anchored there. And being anchored there, because actually, satyam mitya, the mind is the self, but the self is free of the mind, that jnanam, that knowledge is self-evident to you. And so that's the anchor. So that anchor of the stability of yourself is always there, and you're also engaged. But that adhyatma nitya means that always, you know, always your mind is rooted in the truth of your own self. And then he says, vinivritta ka maha, the one whose kamas, desires, are completely gone. By that, vinivritti, completely gone in this way. It's not that I don't have desires, that, you know, I want a drink of water, or, you know, I need to get some gas, or I need to buy this or buy that, or I want this thing or I want that. All of that is there, but it's all mitya. There's no one inside that's saying, I need to have this so that I can be happy. That type of adhyasa is not there. In fact, I would rather, for jnani, I would rather be happy with what's coming my way than getting tangled up in things that aren't part of my life. I would much rather. It's too much energy. There's no reason for it. If it's there as a natural part of my life, as the kind of the unfoldment of Ishvara, take things as they come, that's what I more and more enjoy, rather than trying to get something that belongs to the Joneses. If it's a natural part of your life, it's there to be enjoyed and to be work with. There's no, you don't even notice any desire for it because it's just happening as you're living. You have your life as you're already surrounded by your life. It's already here. And so what if you're present to what's already here? And then the next thing is already here. So you're present to what is already here. So moment by moment, you are with what is already here. And the mind isn't tripping out on what I need to have in order to be happy. And if it is, it's all mitya. So there's no, there's also no residue. I don't need these things because I already have what is the essential truth of them. In other words, if I'm already happy, then it doesn't make sense to look for things to make me happy. Right? If I'm already whole, I'm not going to scramble after things that are supposed to make me whole. In the Bhagavad Gita, they have a verse, a wise person doesn't go into the middle of the river to get a bucket of water. That example, what they mean by that is, they used to always in India, and still do, they dig their wells in the middle of the river in summer. Because in the summer, the river has dried up. And so, but there's so much water, groundwater there. So they put their wells there, and then in the summer, they go and they get water from the well. In the winter, the rivers are flowing, full and flowing. A person is not going to traipse out into the middle of the river to the well to get water, right? Because they already have water, river water. So like that, I'm not going to traipse out to try to find the ananda that I already have. And so such a person, they say, is vinivrittikamaha. For then that those kamas aren't there because I already have the fullness that I would get from the kama, from the desire. And so these things become mithya. That's the key. They can become mithya. You can't say that you don't have any desires because the whole prarabdha karma, you know, manifests in desires. Let me do this and I need to do this. And it's a lot of the gasoline for what keeps you going. But there's nobody inside that's even thinking about it, really. I need this, I must have that in order to be happy. That's just not there, because you already are happy. When you're not happy, all kinds of sadhanas click into place, right, when you're not happy. Yeah. They can even be sadhanas around your knowledge. Okay, let me do some inner child work, or let me bring my knowledge back, or let me contemplate for a while, or let me go to class, or let me do something. Or you can have secondary things. Let me go to a movie. Let me have some popcorn. Let me get a pizza. Whatever. You know, let me visit a friend. These are all sadhanas. They come up immediately. Let me do this. Let me do that. Something to some way, some of the devices I have to work through this sense of hurt or emptiness. But what if you don't feel hurt? What if you don't feel empty? What if you feel whole and complete? Then what? Then these things are meaningless. There aren't any sadhanas. There's really only Ishvara. Right? Because there's no jiva being called into manifestation. I have to do this or I have to do that. This ahankara is not even there. Right? Because I'm fine. And so then I'm just appreciating Ishvara the way things are. Everything's fine. Mind just has a natural shanti. It's only when things aren't fine that we have to start scrambling. You know? So how do we scramble? When we start scrambling, how do we scramble? Well, we have to learn how to scramble in light of our knowledge. You have to understand your mind and what your mind wants and what it needs and why it wants that and why it needs that. You know? Why is it becoming miserable? What are its fears? You have to know what that is, and you don't have to know how to handle it on its own level. You know? There's the objective, you have certain needs, and those things are no problem. Your objective, you just go and do it. And if something doesn't work out, then you try to solve the problem, and you do what you can, that's all. That's not a problem. The problem is when your well-being is, when you become fragile, you know, desperate and fragile, and worried that life is not going to work out for you. What's the meaning? Life's not going to work out for me now. So, then that's fragile. We have to look at that and see what I'm afraid of, what's going on, what's really hurting me. We see it internally, in terms of this inner child work, but we also bring our knowledge. Yeah. Yeah. Then, dvandvara vimuktaha sukaduka sanyahi. This says, those who are free from the opposites. Dvandvas are the opposites. Vimuktaha. Those who are free from the opposites. Dvandvaya vimuktaha. Those opposites known as sukha and dukkha. Sukha, dukkha, sanyahi. Those which are termed sukha. Sanya means termed. Which are termed sukha, pleasure, and dukkha, pain. So the one is vimukta. Completely freed from these dvandvas, from the opposites that we know as sukha and dukkha. Sukha and dukkha means, you know, this situation makes me happy, this situation makes me sad. And that's samsara. Where my ananda, my sukha and pleasure and pain, the world, the situation I find myself in, gives me pleasure and pain. You know? and I am dependent on manipulating the world in such a way that I feel more pleasure than pain. I need to create situations for myself, manipulate situations so that I can have pleasure, and avoid situations that are causing me pain. Which really means that I'm looking at the world in terms of, this makes me happy, this makes me sad. Instead of depending upon my own being for my ananda, and then dealing with the world that Bhagavan gives objectively. Maybe one useful way to understand this is, it says in the Shastra, this loka on this world, in this life, this bhuloka, this life here on the earth plane, you know, is 50-50. Means to have a birth here, you are going to be experiencing 50% papa karmas, 50% punya karmas. Means situations that are part of your prarabdha karma that are designed to be uncomfortable, difficult, the result of papa. And 50% of your situation designed to make you happy, make you comfortable. And so that means that if you look at, you know, 50-50, that your life will be a roller coaster. You know, it's like a roller coaster. That's right. That's why sometimes I tell my, in my spiritual counseling class and to my also my clients, I say, take a piece of paper, divide it in half, and on the one side, write the fairy tale of your life, the beautiful, wonderful life that you've had with so many blessings, so many opportunities, so many ways that Bhagavan has blessed you, so many, just a fairy tale, beautiful. And on the other side, write the nightmare. The horror story of all of the horrible things that have happened to you and all of the, just the nightmare. And now you have them like that. And that's very, you know, if you can do that and then start intertwining them so that when the one fairy tale is happening, you remember the other side, and when the other side is happening, more importantly, you remember this side. That this is a 50-50 proposition, you know? That this life is not designed to be all happy, you know? In fact, one of my close Buddhist friends was telling me, he was talking about this, and he said something like, whenever things are going badly, and I find myself getting upset, I just remember, oh, that's because that's the way this life is meant to be. It's not meant to be just one-sided. It's meant to be both. And so when bad things happen, you can just think, yeah, okay, well, that's what it is. That's what it's meant to be. And in fact, another little corollary to that, with Swamiji, you know, such a dear figure to so many people. All the astrologers in India are all doing his chart all the time, and, you know, looking for, you know, is he safe today? Is he safe today? Is this a good period for him? You know, and all of that. Really, seriously. And doing all kinds of rituals and pujas and everything to make sure, especially in the bad periods, all these rituals all over India are done, you know, to protect him. And one time he was in a two or three year period that was really very, very dangerous astrologically. This is maybe 10 years, 15 years ago. Really bad period. You know? And we were approaching the end of it and he was still okay. Nothing really terrible had happened, but we had still some period of time left. And then we were walking, it was on Salisbury, and it was like in the middle of winter, and there was so much snow and ice. Actually, it was really hard even to come out of the lecture hall and then walk all the way up this snowy path till we'd get to the chalet where he lived. And then there was a, like the porch was made of wood, and that porch would get really icy. So there were the porch, and then some steps down would be icy, you know, and then he had to walk all along. And so one time he was coming off this the kind of the icy porch, and people were by him, kind of protecting him. But he really fell. He fell right at when he got off that, he fell really hard onto the ground, and he hurt his hip. You know, he hurt his hip. Said, "Oh," and he got up and kind of, you know, like if you skin your knee or something, he really hurt his hip, and then had to kind of shake it off, and then he just kind of hobbled with some help. You know, I'm okay, but it was a fall. So he hobbled all the way to the lecture hall, and I said, "Are you all right, Swamiji? Are you all right?" "No, I'm fine." Okay. But he obviously, it was something, you know. And then some of us were all feeling relieved because it's happened, this bad thing that was supposed to happen in the astrology that was so dangerous, you know. Something finally happened, and it wasn't that bad, you know. It happened, he was hurt, it was an event, you know, but it wasn't that bad. So, and that kind of thing is very common. They even have stories about it, you know. Like if you pray, and something bad is aspected, like you can be bit by a cobra. There's some curse on you that you could be bit by a cobra during this period of time, and you instead get bit by a tarantula. And you feel, oh.
Thank God.
Thank God. So having that sort of, you know, freedom, not being afraid of the sukha and dukkha, and knowing that both pass. Anything, both of them pass. Any sukha, any dukkha that is dependent upon a situation will be there and it will pass. And there's, in terms of your own drishti, in terms of your own experience, that sukha and dukkha is taking place in the ananda of your being. Your being isn't going through sukha and dukkha. And so the mind with one foot in your being is experiencing the sukha and dukkha that the universe will throw out to you. It's not swarga loka. So my friend would say, "This isn't swarga loka." Oh, right, it's not swarga loka.
Duh.
But it's helpful, you know, to have those little things. Oh, yeah, it's not swarga loka. Okay. It's nice to understand that. So then he says, so these are all qualities, nirmana moha, jitta sangha doshaha, adyatmanityaha, vinivriktakamaha, grandvaya vimuktaha, sukaduka sanyahi, all these, that gachanti amudaha paramavyayantat. That person who is amudaha, not deluded, not subject to the ajnanam, is free of all of that delusion, that those people, gachanti, they go to that pada, that abode which is avyayam. Avyayam means it's immutable. The abode of my own, which is really because of removing that ajnanam, they reach that abode, not in terms of time or space, but in terms of the removal of ajnanam. I reach that pada, which is avyayam, indestructible, free of time, free of space, not different from me. The recognition of my own being as avyayam, as Brahman. So there's this verse just talking about the nature of the nature of the one who gains this knowledge, gains nishta in this knowledge. So we could say as you watch yourself gaining nishta, as you gain knowledge, there's a little emotional lag time, but the mind is maturing naturally in this direction. That's what you should understand. Your mind is maturing in this direction naturally as you start to gain knowledge of yourself, as you start to gain clarity about your own nature. All of the things that are the effects of ajnanam drop off. The things that are the effects of ignorance, behaviors and ways of thinking and ways of feeling that are just products of ignorance, those just naturally drop off. It takes its own time. But if you look backwards, you can look backwards and look at how you are now, you can appreciate, you know, your mind developing in conformity with your understanding, with your knowledge. And really what it is just dropping off, the natural dropping off of the effects, and the natural effects of ignorance. The effects of ignorance are like a law. They're laws. Like if I take my happiness to be dependent upon a certain situation, then that conclusion is going to generate a lot of different responses toward the environment, the people that help me to get that, the people that are inimical to my enemies and stopping me from getting that. What happens if I'm not able to get it? My whole mind is, all of the emotions that one person can possibly have are generated by that situation. The whole gamut of emotions are generated by that situation. What happens is when I don't project the ananda onto the situation, then I'm not going to generate negative emotions. Why? Because the ananda that is the gasoline or the what causes me to do anything in samsara, I already have. And so the negative spectrum of emotions lose their tenacity. They're not there, you know. Because nobody's stopping me from being happy. Nobody can stop me. I can't even stop myself. Nobody can stop me. Nobody can take the ananda away from me. It doesn't grow old. It's not separate from me. Nobody can do anything. And my mind can't get away from me, and nobody can take my mind away from me. That's the satyam mitya. And so the problem is solved. And so the negative emotions aren't generated. Now, when you feel negative emotions being generated, then you have to bring your mind back to the truth, because all that's happened is that if negative emotions are generated, it's because you've superimposed your ananda onto some situation in the world, and that's not working out for you. Right? You superimpose the ananda onto something, you know, and then it's not working out the way you wanted it to be. And then you start feeling miserable because you've projected yourself onto something and then it's away from you. You've got to get it back. So now what you have to do is get it back not as a physical reality, but you have to get it back by bringing your mind back, removing the ajnana, the moha, right? That delusion that's caused by the ignorance. So what's it they're talking about? Okay, let's take it. That's enough for now. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Arihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Arihi Om.
Yeah. You said At one point, I think you're talking about, but we deal with it internally, but then we bring our knowledge. And is bring our knowledge, is that the, like, the, it's okay, is that what you mean, like, going back?
I think when I was talking internally, when we do this inner child work.
Right.
Yeah, so that's
so my question is about the second part of that.
Yeah.
Then we bring our knowledge. Is that then we come back
to the adult self. To the buddhi, you know, to because your buddhi gets overwhelmed by your emotions and whatnot, and then you can bring your buddhi back, you know, like just bring your knowledge back. Like, who am I really? What about the prarabdha karma? You know, where is the ananda? You know, what is it that I really want? Do I really need this to make me happy? Is that really true? You know, like when there's a lot of different aspects to it. Like one thing that I really like that's always something that we say a talk like this that you can just kind of revel in is that this life really is an unfoldment of prarabdha, your life. The very karmas that brought you here take you all of the way through. And so you can count on that. You know, your life is unfolding according to a certain plan, certain karmas. It's easy to see in hindsight, but at some point you start seeing it, understanding it in the present too, and as you go through. And so then you can kind of relax and enjoy what's coming next and see how Ishvara handles the situation. Because you don't always know what's around the corner. We don't know. The jiva is limited. You can't see what's coming around the corner. But that corner is there, and you'll see what's coming around the corner once you get around it. You know? So you learn how to be kind of patient and interested in Ishvara. And your life is handed over to Ishvara. You know? It's not that idea that I am just a jiva, this is a concrete world, and I have to kind of make it. I have to make my life as though it's all up to you, like this is a concrete, not conscious world. That goes away, and then it becomes something where you appreciate Ishvara as the life unfolds. You let Ishvara do it. You understand what I mean? Instead of thinking that it's you, it's really you are participating in something that's actually given to you.
So you're not wrestling through life then? I mean, it's...
You're not wrestling through life, you're living the life that's given to you. And if you start, it's a little bit of a twist. It's like, am I responding to what's given or am I creating? You know? I see life as really I'm responding always to what's given. And if you're responding to what's given, then what is here is already here. Every moment is already here. So you can look at it, every single moment is already here. You are responding to the moment that is already here. So how are you responding to it? Oh, I like this, I don't like that. Are you just doing what needs to be done? Swamiji says, I do my very best every moment. Whatever's given, I do my best. That's it.
And
he said too, and I find for myself, more, it's not always it, but I'd say the great majority of the time, that is what it is. I think it always is that way, but whether you own that or not is what I'm saying. You're responding to the situation.
But it's still 50-50, this...
No, because the situation, it's much different. You're not creating the situation, you're responding to the situation. Like even when you're born into a family. You're born into a situation. You know, so the situation comes first. You are entering into a situation that's already there.
Mm-hmm.
The situation is always there. And then you can find, you know, the way you respond to the situation creates an ambiance, you know. That's why, to the degree that you are objective in the situation, to that degree there's some peace in the situation. But you are responding to the situation. You're not creating it. You're creating kind of the tumultuous, subjective level of the situation, the emotional ambiance of the situation. You have some control over that. That has to do with your response. You know? That's a beautiful thing.
So, from that perspective, there really isn't suffering or...
Well, say if you want to take ownership over anything, you can take ownership over your response to the situation. And that has a ripple effect. Like say in this situation, now we're all here in this room, and so there's an emotional ambiance in the room that is really the collection of all of us. Right? And so all of us participate in creating that ambiance. But that's all on a subjective level. That's the level of the jiva. Right? But the physical situation is here, and then the emotional ambiance is something that we create collectively. It's so interesting. And you do have some control over that, on how you handle your reactions and what you've learned in terms of kaushalam, in terms of that karma yoga. This is all subtle. Karma yoga, that kaushalam, skill in action, how to treat other people and all this stuff, we're all working on, that's all the level of the jiva, jiva srishti. There's Ishwara srishti, Lord's creation, the objective creation, and Ishwara srishti, the jiva srishti. Srishti means creation, the jiva's creation, which is all this subtle stuff. Like if you think of the 10th man story, the 10th man going just crazy with grief because he thinks the 10th man has drowned in the river. But none of it's true. There's no 10th man has drowned in the river. There's nothing has happened. Everything's fine. But everybody, all of those 10 boys are totally worked up because they think the 10th man has drowned in the river. And the oldest boy is all responsible and everything. And there's a whole jiva srishti going on. You know, and then the wise old man comes and tells them there's really no problem here, and then he reveals the 10th man, and that jiva srishti, that nightmare that they'd all been living, is gone.
Yeah.
It was all moha, that moha, you know.
Yeah.
It's all a delusion, emotional delusion caused by the ajnanam of the reality, you know.
Could you also just... remember, do the kind of one foot in, one foot out. Just remember, oh, I'm me.
Exactly.
And nothing's, you know, and then it's like automatically okay because nothing can.
That's right. That's it. What I mean by pulling back to your knowledge of seeing. I'm fine. There's nothing wrong here. Nothing's happened.
And then you are kind of observing in a certain way that, oh, look, there's this whole thing going on. It's.
And noticing your freedom in it. There's another thing about it, that 10th man example and thing I was talking about. Dharma, that's why Dharma and this Karma Yoga is so good for Antakarana Shuddhi. Because Dharma really has to do with appropriate action or recognizing Ishwara. And that causes very little emotional upset. So the practice of Dharma or that Karma Yoga Buddhi gives a relative shanti in terms of your relationship with the environment and your relationship with others or your relationship with what is happening to you, just on the level of dharma or on the level of taking everything as Ishwara Prasad. It calms down the jiva srishti, whereas the jiva's creation, you know, the subtle emotional turmoil. With jnanam, with self-knowledge, that jiva srishti is resolved, because what is called the emotional turmoil on the deepest level is self-ignorance, which causes me to project my well-being out onto the world and then get upset when the projection's not working out properly, you know. Because from Bhagavan's standpoint, you know, this projection is not there. That, oh, I need it to be this way or I need it to be that way in order to be happy. That projection's not there because there's no jnanam. It's a result of karma. You know, this situation is the result of karma, this situation is the result of karma, but there's no ananda or lack of ananda. The ananda only has for its source atma, the self. That is the ananda. There is no other ananda. There's just mind, the mind that gets itself into tumult, tumultuous, you know, state.
So even if everything is kind of like perfect or everything is all chaotic.
The self is the same. Your atma is the same, whether it's a sukha situation, all meant to just be so good.
Yeah.
You might have a sukha vritti, thought modification, enjoying this wonderful situation, but the atma is exactly the same. If you have a dukkha vritti, something bad is happening out here, you know, there's the mind is tumultuous. The Atma is exactly the same. It's not, never changes. And so the mind that knows that has the stability of the changelessness called avyayam, the immutable nature of your being. And you never change, ever. You can't change. It's impossible. And so what about if your mind has recognized me that is immutable? That's the one foot in to myself, you know? One foot is with myself, and then the other is just engaging in the world as a jiva, as an individual in the world, who has relationships and all of this. But all the while, there's freedom because the self is free. It's not because the mind is free. The mind is free because the self is free. That's the freedom of the mind, is the recognition of myself is free. Mind is just always changing, but it has a free self. Remember, like the pot is always the clay. Clay is free of the pot. The pot is never not the clay. So my mind is never not me. Even though it can be going through so many different things, I am its self. And the self that I am is never changing. It's absolutely free because it's whole and complete and not lacking.
You say that Jiva Srishti and Pratibhasaka are the same thing, mm-hmm. just looking at it slightly differently, and saying Vyavahara.
Yeah. Ishwara Srishti, Vyavahara. Jiva Srishti, Pratibhasaka. Good. Yeah. Brahman Paramartika Satyam.
Could you explain that a little bit more?
Oh, it's just when you say when you bring in Vyavahara and Pratibhasaka.
Oh, that's all mitya.
Oh, mitya. Exactly. Then you bring Satyam. So you've got Brahman, Ishwara Srishti, Jiva Srishti.
What's interesting is that, you know, this definition of your nature adds a whole other dimension to the word freedom. I mean, the pursuit of freedom.
Yeah, because really the freedom is your being. That is what freedom is. Because your being is existence, which is changeless, it's consciousness, and it's ananda. The very me is totally free. It's free of time, it's free of space, it's free of objectivity. Nothing can touch it. Nothing can make you unfree. You can't become something else.
And that doesn't have anything to do with civil rights or a form of government.
No.
You know what I mean?
It all has to do with Kali Yuga.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kali Yuga.
Anything that contributes to Antikara Nishuddhi makes it more likely that you're going to realize who you are, right?
The more, yeah, the undercard.
The more agitated and tumultuous things are, the more difficult.
That's true. And undercard of shuddhi, the karma yoga and all these things really help to give you a mind that's available for this knowledge. You know? The mind, you say that knowledge is, the pramana is working. It's all taking place, but your mind is filled with pain and distraction and worry and all this stuff. The teaching's taking place. You'd love to be able to listen to it, but you're so upset that you're not available. Or even if you're not upset, but still, I really want this thing, and I want this thing, and I want this thing, again, you're not available. So the antikarna shuddhi, we say purity of mind and all of that, but that's kind of a, I don't know, it's a little, makes me feel away from it. Mm-hmm. If you think of antikarna shuddhi really as a mind which is available to this teaching, it's available. Because otherwise, how can the pramana work? The pramana requires, that means of knowledge requires a mind that can receive it. Because the self is here, see, the atma is here, the teacher is here, and what else is necessary? Well, the mind to receive it. Your sense organs are here, the self is here, say the appropriate teaching is here. Then what's the problem?
Students.
Yeah. The student's mind is not available. So when we say antikarna shuddhi, all we really mean is that that mind is available to receive this teaching.
It's like tuning in a radio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that means, so then you start thinking, well, what would that mean? Well, that's what we call the sadhana chatushtya, these fourfold sadhanas, which have to do with the quality of a student's mind, viveka. They have to have that ability to discriminate between what is, to recognize that everything here is time-bound. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that is free of that? Everything's time-bound. Vikara is vairagya. Means if everything is time-bound, there's no way for me to receive anything lasting from it. That's vairagya. So it can't fulfill me, really. And then there's this, from that, there's a mumukshutvam, a desire for liberation. You know, to really be able to discover what would make me whole and complete. That's the mumukshutvam. And then there's the what we call the shamadhi shatka, this group of qualifications, shama, dhamma, upadhi, siksha, shraddha, samadhanam, these qualifications, mental attitudes that we develop. You know, everybody who comes to this knowledge has this viveka, vairagya, etc., to some degree, to enough degree to make this teaching interesting for you. Without that viveka or vairagya, discrimination, no dispassion, you know, you already have the answer. If I just could do this and that, I'd be fine.
Well, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, you wouldn't be here. It's not interesting.
What did you say? Shamada?
Shama, Dhamma, Upadati, Uparati, Upadati, Titiksha, Samadhanam, and Shraddha. There's a group of six qualifications, attitudes.
So you talked about
the six on?
Oh,
Shraddha.
Okay.
So Viveka is one, Vairagya, Shama, Dhamma, Upadati, Titiksha, Samadhanam, Shraddha, the group of six, and then Mumukshutvam.
My question is totally
different. Oh, go ahead.
So you talked about when the mind is, but when you're feeling fragile and worried, and your mind is miserable, and you said that you should know your mind's needs. That's a different thought to me than you should be trying to have dispassion or kind of like letting go.
Okay, because I'm holding two things. One is kind of inner understanding, kind of that inner child work, or what it is that you're really asking for. So it's two levels. What does the little one want? That's the one thing. Then also, when your mind, when your buddhi, your intellect, the one who's gaining this knowledge, is upset, then you can ask it, like, what is it that you really want? What is it that you need? And then when it, and I'm talking on an adult level, what do you want to get from this? You know, what is it that you really need? And so then start bringing back your, bringing your knowledge back in.
Okay. You know? Got it. And you ask it.
You ask, yeah. You just ask your mind a question and it'll answer. And you ask it another question. Yeah, the mind answers you, right? Like if I say to you, you know, if I ask you a question, if I ask myself a question, what if I ask myself, you know, do I want to read this book now? And then we'll say, no, not now. Or whatever, it doesn't matter what it is, you know.
Just got to be able to hear it. Hear the right answer. Or the appropriate or authentic answer, maybe.
The authentic answer. Where really, what do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like if you ask yourself a question like, why do I really want to do this? And then let your mind toy with it. Maybe you don't have an answer. Say, why do I really want to do this? What is it that I really want? And that your mind might not know, but let it try to answer it. Let it play with it. And then you can think about what it's saying in terms of your knowledge, you know? Especially, it doesn't matter unless it's causing you problems. You're not going to ask, well, why do you really want to do this? Unless it's hurting you in some way. Then she said, I don't know, I want to. What difference does it make, you know? But if it's causing you a problem, then that inquiry is helpful. If it's hurting you or making you feel inadequate.
Now, is it possible, like, if you have an inner child issue that really keeps you kind of, because it has gone so unconscious, and it's so, has struck such a deep place in the character of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody develops a really high level of jnana, you know, of jnana, you know. It's now, because it seems to be like, also when you talk about it, it's kind of like developing. There's a personal development and there's a spiritual development. Maybe one can look at it that way. And so they both need to kind of harmonize and interface.
But they will naturally. I don't think you have to worry about that. Like if you,
right.
You know, you can do any amount of inner child work.
Uh-huh.
And you can do it on a higher level also. But they're both taking care of you and of each other. They're harmonizing on their own.
So you think if the jnana is reached in a person, that will kind of, the inner child process will catch up with that? So just
it will, though. I think also that, you know, we as adults are kind of a product, and our psyche is a product of all of our experiences, including our childhood experiences. And so we have certain wounds that give us our character, whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
Those don't, you know, necessarily go away, but they're also like scars instead of open sores.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful way to.
You know, and so you can still have sensitivity or weakness in a certain area, but you know about it and you know how to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And also it gives you compassion. I mean, if you don't have never had any problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or any sensitivities or vulnerabilities inside, how can you even relate to the human race?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have those, but there comes a time when, just from the work that you've done and from your knowledge, it's handleable. It's not something that's like an open wound. But still, you're vulnerable in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And you always will be, probably.
I was thinking the other day about, because something was taking a long time for me to kind of process in my mind, and I was getting irritated about that because I should be better at that by now. And it's kind of like, you know, like when you get sick and then you start to get better, but you don't get better soon enough to suit you.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to take as long as it takes.
Yeah, it takes as long as it takes.
So hard to come to terms with that sometimes.
Yeah, it is. In fact, when I was in training with this one therapist who a Jungian analyst named John Steinhilber, he was my, what do you call it, supervisor for many years. And one time, he told in his own analysis, he had said to his analyst, "When am I going to stop telling you the story?" Same story, same problem, over and over and over.
Yeah.
And his analyst said, "When it's over. That's all. It's not like you can say it once or twice or complain about the same thing once. Okay, I've complained about this 10 times now."
So there's no judgment about this.
No, thing. It's over.
I mean,
because
that's a tendency to think, like, let's get it on, you know? I mean, the broken record guy?
Yeah, that's what he was feeling, like a broken record, always complaining about the same thing. His therapist said, when is this going to stop? Aren't you sick of me? Aren't you sick of me talking about this? I have clients telling me that. Aren't you sick of me saying the same thing? I said, no, it's different every time, actually. And if you really think about it, it's, see, the thing is, then understand about it. This can be helpful for you. You think you're complaining, you think you're saying the same thing, but the person who's saying it is different. Because the person has, the buddhi has already assimilated a little bit more knowledge. So even you're coming back to the same issue, but all the while that you're coming back to the same issue, you're accruing some strength and some knowledge around that issue. The person keeps on changing. There comes a time when you either give up on that issue and say, okay, that's just part of me, it doesn't matter, I just leave it, don't worry about it. But you can't really say that as long as it's torturing you.
But then it's not the same as a broken record.
No, it isn't. It's not. Even if you ask the same Vedanta question over and over and over, the teacher's going to get tired of hearing that question. How many times have I asked it? That's not how it is, because the person who is asking is different. Mm-hmm. So you have to remember the person who is asking is different.
And so is the teacher.
Sure, and so is the teacher. Different because you've accrued more knowledge, more connections. And so the person who's asking has much more knowledge, or incrementally more knowledge than the person who asked it before, even though it seems like the same question. It's not. And also the answer goes into, is understood, is taken in differently.
It plays also into the tendency of the human mind to look at the glass half empty instead of half full, you know, which is also a problem, because if you really focus on the changes, there's so many changes you can see. I mean, just like when you sometimes say, well, look back at your life, you know, look at what you have understood, instead of just looking at all the things that are still not perfectly working, and then getting really outgrowing the illusion that, like you said tonight too, that it needs to be perfect, you know.
That's true, and I think you get humble with age also. So
right, Penny?
That's right.
So, Swamiji said that too. That was a kind of an eye-opener for me. Once he kind of said, tongue-in-cheek a little bit, he was serious actually. He said, I kind of have just learned over the years that you don't really change anybody. You're the one that changes. You change yourself. You know, and I think it just, that's not quite the appropriate story, but it meant something to me when he said it. Time?
Bhagavad Gita.
Bhagavad Gita. And that's it.